go to conferences where the person is speaking because their church is X amount in size. I think actually we've got to redefine success today. Success is not numeric size. Success is fulfilling the call and the plans of God for our life.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of The Profile, because I am here on location in Manchester. I've been very kindly invited here by Glyn Barrett. Glyn is the senior pastor of Audacious Church, which began 17 years ago with 50 people and has since grown to reach many thousands and become a multi-site church. We're going to hear all about Audacious and all about Glyn's own life. Glyn, thank you so much for welcoming me here to Manchester. It's wonderful to be here.
Sam, welcome to Manchester. Yeah, it's good to have you up north.
Yes, it's good to get out of the London southeast part of the Now, here on the show, we always like to go back to the very beginning and hear about a person's early life. So why don't you tell me something of life growing up? I understand that you were born into a Christian household, and even your dad was a pastor growing up. Is that right?
Yeah, all true. So my name's Glyn, G-L-Y-N. So for those who are a discerning Brit, they'll understand that's not English, it's Welsh. Mum and dad are from the valleys of South Wales, actually. And both brought up in many senses, you know, going to the Welsh chapels and those sorts of things. But both of my parents had a real encounter with Jesus in their teenage years, actually, and had a radical conversion. My dad actually became a Christian because he broke a man's leg playing football. And my dad was instantly apologetic. And the man said, "I'll forgive you if you come to church with me tomorrow." And so the next day, my dad went to church, heard the gospel, actually preached for the first time, and got radically saved. Mum and dad called me Glyn because they wanted everybody to know in the world, if ever I travelled, that I was Welsh. And I just said to my mum, "No, they actually just don't think you can spell very well because everyone calls me Glyn." But yeah, so Welsh parents. I was actually born here in Manchester. My dad was a pastor. Mum and dad were pastors. But then when I was two, moved to Australia.
Which explains the accent.
I know, it's strange, isn't it? Yeah.
But you were there, I guess, in such a pivotal moment in your life. So this is growing up, even into your teens.
Yeah.
And that was enough for the accent to be bedded in and to stay with you for life.
To stick. So I stayed in Australia until I was 15, came back to Manchester for 5 years. And so I need to put this in there, that I'm a lifelong Manchester City fan. I'm not a glory hunter. I've followed them all my life, even when I was a child in Australia. Because, you know, as we all know, that most Manx support Manchester City. Anyway, so that's slightly contentious. But, was here from 15 to 20, did my A-levels here, worked for a few years, and then I went back to Australia to go to Bible seminary, read theology, did that for 3 years, married my South American Australian bride, and then we moved back to England straight after marriage, so...
And tell me about that moment or series of moments where faith, you can remember faith becoming your own. Because it's one thing for your dad to be a pastor. My dad was a pastor.
Yeah.
There are moments in life, aren't there, where you think, I can't just live off my parents' faith and this has to be real to me. Do you remember moments like that?
I have got two definitive moments that were life-changing for me. The first one was as a 12-year-old boy, actually. In my dad's church in Australia, we had quite a large youth group, around 150, 160 teenagers. But for many of the boys, our relationship with God was actually more based on who our parents were. So a group of us got together and arranged a series of prayer meetings from Monday night to Saturday night in our youth pastor's office. And we had two rules: no adults, because they were part of our problem. And secondly, we didn't want any girls in the room because we didn't want to be distracted. We just wanted to... And actually, we started to pray Monday night, Tuesday night, you know, Wednesday, Thursday. And every night, people had unique encounters with the Lord. And on Saturday night, I was so impacted by the presence of God, by the Holy Spirit, that I knew my life was changed. And came out of that prayer time just knowing that I was called to be a preacher, to go into ministry. But then when I was 15, I'd reached a moment where I was pretty tired with church. It was familiar to me, just the liturgy of services. I just knew the way things went. And, I'd become aware that many of our churches, we were more known in the community for what we couldn't do than what we could do. That there were lots of laws and rules and regulations. And I would hear some adults say, "Aren't we having a great time in church?" And people would say, "Yes." But on the inside, I'd be like, "Well, not really. I'm, I, I couldn't quite work out why I felt either disconnected or even bored at times. And then I was reading my Bible, Exodus chapter 3. Moses meets God. Moses says to God, "Who are you?" And God says, "I am." And just that phrase was a moment. It was almost like the first time ever that God, his word, became living. Because all my life, I thought God's name was I'm not. I'm not allowed to wear jeans. I'm not allowed to kick a ball on a Sunday. I'm not, and the rules were endless on what I'm not allowed to do. But I discovered God's name was I am. Even his name was permissive. It was open. It was life-giving. And I took my Thompson Chan Reference Bible and I followed it through from Exodus chapter 3 and realized that God is this God of life and liberty and freedom. Galatians 5:1 is for freedom Christ has set you free. That verse, John 10:10, Jesus said, "I've come that you might have life and life to the full." He wasn't saying to me as a teenage boy, "I've come to give you the type of life where you secretly wish you weren't a Christian so you could have fun." I've come to give you the life that you may experience fullness of life. And those moments as a 12-year-old and 15-year-old were so deep that I've never looked back, just never had a season of wanting to walk away from God or even walk away from church, just revelation of God's goodness, his call and purpose, and they were life-changing.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit more about what happened later when you moved from Australia to the UK. I think you're going to be a youth pastor here. Again, really pivotal moment, but I think quite a tough moment. I mean, you lost your dad shortly before coming back. That must have brought up questions of, you know, having to leave your mum in Australia to come to the UK to minister.
Yeah.
Take me back to that time and what your memory is of it.
Yeah, that was really an emotional time. I mean, Sophie and I got married at the end of Bible college. We were 3 years in Bible college. We had a two-month honeymoon in South America. My wife's family are South American, so that was quite an easy connection there. And it was actually the week that we were due to move to England from Australia that my dad died, the same time. And that was a great season of turmoil. Dad was 60, so quite young in many senses, and really living fulfilled. He was the professor of theology in our Bible seminary. It did call into question, do we move to England? Do we not move to England? About 18 months earlier, I'd had a moment in a prayer time actually with a friend in my second year of Bible college. And God impressed upon my heart three things. Number one, you're going to go back to England. Number two, you'll plant a church. And number three, you'll lead Assemblies of God in Great Britain. And all these three things just seemed like way out there, that they could never come to pass. They were impossible, really. And yet we had this growing awareness that we're meant to move to England. So Dad dying was really bad timing in many senses. I began to become aware that the devil knows the Bible better than most theologians. I was conscious that, you know, Paul talks to Timothy about looking after widows and orphans, those in distress. Now my mum's a widow. It's my responsibility as son, as really the man in the house now, to look after mum. But, you know, through talking to mum and through talking to different professors in the Bible seminary and my pastor in Australia at the time, we just knew that it was God's plan for us to move. But it was tough, you know. I remember walking towards the British Airways jumbo. I said to the Lord, give me another sign that we're meant to move to Sheffield in England here. And I looked out and the British Airways jumbo was called the City of Sheffield. And we wept our way under the plane, wept for 24 hours coming across. Lived in the back bedroom of somebody's house on an airbed for 2 months. You know, rented a very old house for another 2 years. You know, a lot of people don't see that. A lot of people see this that exists now. And there would be some critics who say, oh Glenn, look at what you got. Look, isn't that amazing? But it's taken a bit to get here, but God's faithfulness through it all is the thing that I can truly hold up and say, you know, if it wasn't for God's goodness and faithfulness and just making himself real, we just knew he was with us even in those dark times.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk a bit about the growth of Audacious, as I said, from 50 people to quite literally thousands. Take it right back to the beginning. Where does the vision for Audacious come from?
One of my elders in our church, he's also one of our campus pastors, and another friend. We were in a prayer time together. We were youth pastors in separate churches, and I prayed a prayer. I said, Lord, help us to be audacious in our steps. and I paused, and it was like the presence of God sat on that moment. And I opened one eye and I looked at them, and they were looking at me, and I said, "That's it, isn't it?" They went, "We're called to be audacious." And so the word audacious sort of really came out of a prayer time. And then we were gathering some of our youth groups together. We were running a youth conference called Audacious, and we did that for probably 3 or 4 years actually before Audacious Church started. So by the time we started the church, we already had a band, we had a culture, we had a team of people, so that when we actually moved to Manchester, you know, which had, I'd really felt God tell me it was time to go home, the people of my birth, the people of origin for me, we already had a way of doing things. So there was a team of 8 of us actually who started the church. We didn't have any churches or youth groups that came to Audacious Conference, so we weren't coming into the city to rob people in any sense of the imagination, you know, and we just knew that God was calling us into the city, a big city, to try to make as big a difference as possible. And we were conscious that, you know, one of the ways to do that was to, and this was part of our vision statement for many years, to be a church numerically so large that we create traffic jams. You know, in Manchester, when there's a traffic jam, it can be for a few reasons. Usually when football's on, there's a traffic jam. There's a concert up the road, there's a traffic jam. And I realised that, you know, on a work day, it would take me about 40 minutes to drive from my house in the suburbs to the city centre. And on a match day, I would drive past Old Trafford, it'd take me an hour and a half to drive to the city centre. But on a Sunday, it would take 14 minutes. And so the question is this, is what does revival look like in Manchester? And the answer was traffic jams. So many people go into church, and not just our church, but all the churches, that it's creating traffic jams. And the whole idea that if there's a visitor into Manchester on a Sunday and they're stuck in a traffic jam, they're wondering why, they're like, why is there traffic? They get the attention of a local Manc and a car next door. What's going on? A City United playing? No, no, it's not football. Haven't you heard? God is back. So there was that sense that we already had culture. We already had big dreams. The goal was always to think big and to become a large numeric church to increase the potential impact that we as a local church could have across the city.
And the exclamation mark?
Well, the exclamation mark was a branding exercise, actually. Back in the day, I mean, we were probably...
I mean, there's some famous branding with punctuation in the question mark. I'm thinking of Delirious with question mark.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I have the same, like, we're old enough to remember that being a thing.
Yeah.
I feel like we've got form here.
Well, you know, the Nike tick, things like that, you know, the Starbucks logo. And so the idea is this, is that we can use branding. So the exclamation mark, it's a statement. And so now our vision is a statement, is a church that makes a statement. Mm. And so the exclamation mark is a statement in and of itself. So it was a branding exercise, it's exclamation mark with the A. It annoys some grammar geeks, but it's, what's really strange now is after having had this branding for 15 years, and it's gone through different refreshes, is now whenever I see the word audacious in print, in a normal sentence, if it hasn't got the exclamation mark, my brain looks at it and goes, that's spelt wrong, isn't it?
I think it's fascinating how being big was part of your DNA, was part of your vision from the very beginning. But I guess my question is, when it comes to church, is bigger always better?
That's a really good question. And the answer is both yes and no, I think. I think if the goal is just numbers for the sake of numbers, then that cannot be a healthy thing. You know, it's been a popular leadership statement that says healthy things grow. I actually don't agree with that. I think that healthy things stay vibrant. You know, in my last house, I had a box hedge out the front. It was healthy, but it didn't grow. My dog is healthy, but it's not growing. And we wouldn't look at it and say it's not healthy because it's not growing. So I think that bigger is not always best. I think if there's an intentionality in size, and I think for a local church pastor and local church to know what they're called to, I think is probably one of the most important things. Mm. So one of the things that we realise, we're in a city of Greater Manchester, 3 million people. To be a church of thousands makes a statement of sort. But then people say to me, it must be big having a big, or great having a big church. And I say, well, compared to what? Because 200 yards up the road is the Manchester Arena. And tonight they'll have 23,000 people at a concert there. And, you know, a few miles away from here is the Etihad Stadium with 66,000 people. And you know, Old Trafford is over there with 80,000 people. So what's our comparison? So bigger is not always best. But the model that we've got for this, and the model, I think, for megachurch is probably some of the terminology that's got a really bad rap these days. But the megachurch is nothing new in terms of numeric size. If we go back to, you know, the Antioch church in the book of Acts, that was mega in size. But even if we look in the history of our nation, our cathedrals were numerically large in attendance. They had big buildings, they had big lands. They became resourcing centres for the parishes, for missions, etc. So that's really the mindset behind bigger being best in this context, is that we're going for big so we can become a resource mechanism, not so we can just go, hey, look how many people we've got.
And I think the positives and the strengths of big church are quite obvious to people. I mean, we're sitting here in your church's video studio, and the fact that you have a video studio, which I know many churches would covet, gives you fantastic opportunity to broadcast on social media and to put brilliant media out there that communicates the gospel. And that's very obvious that when you're a church of this kind of size, you have the ability to gather a large number of people in one room. These are all positives. You say that bigger isn't always best. So what are the negatives? What are the drawbacks of being a church of thousands?
Well, I think one of the drawbacks is you can be in a large church and get lost in a large crowd, can't you? So in a church that's smaller, and you know, over my lifetime, I have been in smaller churches, of course. When you're not in the room, you can be missed because you make up a significant portion of either the seating or the community there. When you're talking about auditoriums that seat thousands, the danger can be is that unless you willingly get plugged into the pastoral care community of the church, which fundamentally, and the best way for that probably is small groups, then that means that if you're not there, then there's not necessarily going to be anyone who says, oh, I didn't see you in church on Sunday. Now, one of the things that I do is this, is I always stand on the auditorium doors before and after the services on a Sunday, unless we have a guest here. And the reason I do that is because it's amazing, actually, how you can pick up on the thousands of people coming in, and you begin to register who's there and who's not there, and you can have significant conversations within that. So actually, there are times when I'll see people and go, oh my gosh, I haven't seen you for ages. And it's because one of two things. Number one, they haven't been in church for ages. Or number two, maybe they're using the other door to come into the auditorium. But I think sometimes people can get lost in a large crowd. You can live in a big city, be lonely. You can be in a big church and be lonely. But you know what? I've met people in small churches that are lonely as well. So I think there's got to be an intentionality for the church to genuinely be sincere in their connection with people.
It is interesting that, I mean, quite literally every mega church leader I think I've ever spoken to has observed when you have a large church, small groups become just so vital. And it's really interesting that you reach for that as an example, that, as you say, I think a common criticism of mega churches, well, they're so big, how can you do community? When in reality, every mega church leader knows that already, and they're trying to build. I mean, do you feel like there is that misunderstanding sometimes from Christians that it can be quite easy to criticise? And I don't know if there's almost a British sense of when something gets a bit too big, we want to knock it down, and we get a bit cynical. Have you picked up on that at all?
Yeah, I think there is definitely a negative press that can go along with leading a mega church for lots of reasons. You know, negative media. We hear, don't we, about church pastors in large churches that are having failings, and that's fairly well publicised. But I do think as well that, you know, every day at the airport, thousands of planes take off and land really safely. We only ever hear about the ones that have an accident. And I think that, you know, for every maybe one mega church where there's crisis of scandal, there may be 100 smaller churches that are equally having the same scandal or crisis, but we're not hearing it to the same amount. And I think balance is really important. So I think for all pastors, really, you know, there's a great verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that says, the devil tempts us with no new thing. It's only the same things. And I remember 28 years ago in Bible seminary, they said the devil's going to get you in three ways.
Money, sex and power.
Money, sex and power. Girls or guys, gold and glory. Those three things. So if we're aware of that, then
you'd think, wouldn't you?
Given
that so many decades we've all been saying the same thing of they're the three big temptations, and yet, as you say, sadly, these things keep coming up. I mean, how do you guard against that personally? You must think, I don't want to be the next person in the headlines for all the wrong reasons, you know. And again, you're counselling pastors, what's your advice to them to put the safety net, the guardrails, call it what you will, to make sure that you keep doing what God's called you to do and you don't fall away?
You know, we've got to be absolutely diligent in all those areas. So, you know, when it comes to money, that's a big one. That's a big one. So it's not just about how much a person receives in terms of remuneration, stipend, income. It's what you do with your money. You know, financial probity is everything. How generous are you? So what mechanisms are we putting in place to make sure that money doesn't get in our hearts? You know, so levels of generosity in that. But I think relationship with the opposite sex, people who are not your spouse, etc. You know, Billy Graham is well reported in terms of he would not travel with somebody who wasn't his wife or, you know, daughter. I think being that vigilant is actually really, really important.
And so, because that particular example has come under some criticism.
It has.
It sort of said, well, doesn't that treat the opposite sex as if they're all temptresses out to get you? And that's not a healthy view of women.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you think there's still something in what's been called the Billy Graham rule? I think the rule at one point was you'd never be left alone in a room with a woman who wasn't your spouse or a family member, which I think for some people now feels in our society a bit extreme. What's your view?
I think it's to do with the nature of humankind, the fallen nature of humankind. And I think there are levels of criticism that we all need to be aware of exists, but we also need to know ourselves and actually go, I actually don't care you saying what you say. I know me. I know the fallen nature of humankind. Therefore, I don't want to go the way of so many other peers. So say what you want, but you know what? The longevity of my marriage, my salvation is more important to me than any negative criticism that anyone would bring on those sorts of things. So I've got really clear guidelines on what I do and don't do in that area. And they may be open to interpretation to others, but I'm okay with that because, you know, these three things are the three things that always get all the pastors. So let's just make sure it doesn't happen to us.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk a bit about church planting. Audacious itself is planting new campuses, it feels like, all the time. And you have a role actually, you know, nationally and even beyond that when it comes to helping pastors to plant churches. And I suppose I want to take you right back to the early days of Audacious and ask you, you know, what were the mistakes in the early days of Audacious that you've now learned from that you pass on to others? Well, don't do it this way. We tried it this way. And I suppose the interesting thing about church planting is so much depends, doesn't it, on context. And there will be things that are unique to Manchester that work here that don't work in another part of the country or the world. But again, I imagine there are principles that you've learned of this is how to do it, this is how not to do it, that you're trying to pass on to the next generation. It would be great to hear a bit more about it.
You know, I think one of the things that's one of the greatest principles for church planting is commit to the adventure and not be so hard on yourself when things don't go the way you'd hoped or planned it to be. You know, I'm currently doing a doctoral program and I'm my doctoral research is on leadership styles in the church. And I think that in the early days of church planting, many church planters are very autocratic in their life, in their leadership. It's almost a command and conquer. We're going to do this. We're not going to do that. Because one of the dangers of church planting is when you say, hey, we're planting a new church, invariably you get people who are disgruntled in other churches maybe wanting to come and be a part of it. There's all sorts of things. And if we're not careful, too many voices can potentially ruin a culture that you're trying to create of saying this is who we are as a church. And so the command and conquer autocratic leadership style can kick in and you can become almost too ruthless maybe, and then become so serious that you don't allow yourself to make mistakes. And I would just say to every church planter out there, be open to making mistakes. You know, try things with buildings. Try buildings. Try new ideas. You know, try times that maybe have never worked in other contexts, but maybe will work in yours. And when things don't go according to plan, don't just say, oh, I failed. Just say, well, I've found another way that it's not going to work, you know, in our context. So I think enjoying the adventure. Church planting is great, because church planting is small, and church planting is vulnerable, and church planting is an adventure. And I can honestly say that when we planted our second campus of Audacious, which is in Chester, nearly eight years ago, I felt like I was coming alive again. But to go to Chester and go, who's going to turn up today? You know, are we going to have some crazy moments in Sunday? The adventure of that, there's nothing quite like it. And I've discovered that God is not boring and Christianity is not boring. We get boring because we stop embracing adventure. So that's the big thing, and I'm really encouraging our pastors across the nation, and now in my new role with AG Global across the world, is embrace the adventure, because there's stories yet to be told.
Hi, I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Every month, our team brings you deep, thoughtful journalism around the biggest topics affecting you as a Christian today. Our mission is to help you encounter God through the magazine. The latest issue features Switchfoot lead singer John Foreman, plus we're previewing the largest gathering of Christians ever. Find out more in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine.
There might be some people wondering, well, there's a lot of churches in our nation, indeed around the world, that are really struggling, that are maybe shrinking. Why not revitalise those existing churches, pour lots of resources into all these buildings we already have, stop some of these buildings from being torn down and converted into blocks of flats? Perhaps don't understand the need for starting a new church. Why not just revitalise ones we have? What would you say?
You know, I had this very same conversation with Nikki Gumbel on Sunday, actually. And Nikki Gumbel confirmed a fairly popular statistic that's told in church planting circles, that it actually takes 7 years to revitalize a church that's either in decline or, you know, is closing, whatever, versus what you can achieve in 7 years of planting something new and creating something new. And I think that some leaders are actually called to that tenure of 7 years of change, the patience, the, you know, the sojourn of what that looks like. But for other people who are maybe pioneers, they're wired just a little bit differently. So I think for a lot of people, it actually comes back to call a little bit.
Place for both, perhaps.
And I think both are absolutely right.
Yeah.
Some buildings are not fit for purpose today. You know, we had a brilliant opportunity to take over a building of a church that was closing in Chester, actually, maybe 2 or 3 years into the journey of our church, and it was a beautiful 17th century church building. The auditorium would seat 450. The roof had just been done, so there was no thermometer needed to repair the roof. It had a minor hall of 300 seats, but the only problem with it was it was on a dual carriageway. The nearest parking was 15 to 20 minutes walk away. And there was no drop-off zone. You couldn't pull up to drop people off. You couldn't do weddings, funerals, or anything like that. So there were just too many things that made it not feasible for us. So I think both are good. Yeah.
I guess this leads us into to talking a bit more big picture about the state of the UK. So I put it this way. There are two very different views on church planting. There's a kind of pessimistic view of, well, culture's becoming increasingly secular, Christians are being increasingly marginalised. Gosh, you're brave doing church planting. That doesn't strike me as the mindset you have. You strike me as having the opposite mindset of God is on the move, things are happening, let's go for it. You know, is that your belief? And I guess, how do you instil that into a culture of a church? Because I think for a lot of Christians, the world can feel a bit negative. It can feel like it's actually harder to be a Christian now than it was, say, 10 years ago. As I say, you don't strike me as that, having that view. So how do you view it, and how do you instill a more positive, hopeful culture?
Well, by nature, I'm a sanguine. So, you know, the glass is not half empty. It's actually not even half full. I think Psalm 23 is my cup runneth over. So there's definitely a theology that underpins the life of our church and ministry, which is actually we're not a pessimistic people. By theological choosing, we are a cup runneth over type people. And I think my hope and my prayer would be for everybody in business and in life in our church that they would adopt, you know, and grow to understand what that means for them. But, you know, we are living, I think, more and more so in a post-Christian world in this nation, aren't we? You know, I recently did some research in a Church of England high school, and 180 students interviewed them over the space of a week, and ask them seven key questions, which are really the seven questions that define the worldview of a generation. And all these children had come through primary school into secondary school, and some of these questions were about God, about faith, about the origin of morality, right and wrong, different things like that. And it was amazing to me how many of the students had little to no idea about God, life after death, whatever. In a Judeo-Christian culture, these young people just didn't have it. So therefore, the baggage, and I think one of the greatest challenges to planting church is actually not is religious baggage that people bring into the equation. But if we're actually dealing with a secular baggage, a baggage of darkness, of the troubles with humanity and different things like that, I think it gives us the opportunity to shine the light of the gospel in such a way that even a small light makes a really big difference. So I think now's a perfect time actually for churches to plant, to go either multi-site or do something new. You know, Jesus looked out over Jerusalem. He had compassion. He wept. He saw that the people were lost, without a sheep, without a shepherd. And I think that's true now more than ever before.
Just to be clear, the motivation here for church planting is evangelism. So it's
100%.
It's the reason you're planting a church is because you want to reach people who never heard the gospel. And the church planting is really just a vehicle to just get the message.
Yeah. There's nothing like somebody planting a church to be desperate enough for people to be there that they go out to tell people the good news of Jesus Christ, as opposed to being comfortable with 100, 200, 300, 500, whatever size church it is. It actually fuels the missional call in somebody's life. Yeah. So, you know, I can honestly say that in our movement of churches, we are seeing that church planting is the most effective way, one of the most effective ways, to actually see people get out there and one for Jesus.
And what is your take on the spiritual kind of climate of the UK? Because, you know, you say Audacious has been around for 17 years. Has it got harder? Is it getting easier? Where are we at? I've heard people say that the tide is turning, we're starting to see green shoots. I've heard other people say, look at the statistics. You've got entire denominations predicted to go extinct in the next 20 years. So there's not much certainty out there about this question. Where are we at right now in the UK? Where is our culture at when it comes to spiritual awakening?
I think denominations and movements will come and go. You know, Audacious will come and one day it'll go. The name will be forgotten. Somebody may write a nice chapter about it one day in a book in 100 years' time. And I think as long as we're not precious over any other name other than the name of Jesus, then we won't allow the pessimism of a declining denomination or church movement and the nostalgia of that cause our hearts undue duress. And while it may be true that there are some denominations, and we know it, it's well documented, they're planning their demise in selling their buildings and less and less ministers being ordained, etc., etc., we're also seeing new movements of churches growing up that are young, vibrant, evangelistically zealous, very quadrilateral in the sense, in the same way the evangelical church was quadrilateral in the foundations that they believed. And we're just seeing it presented in a new way, in a new season. So I'm really excited by the opportunities. You know, I think that people are as hungry now as they've ever been. And it's just our responsibility as the church to put the gospel of Jesus Christ in a context that they can understand without watering down what the Bible says, you know.
So tell me some of those encouraging stories that keep you going on the hard days and you think, if life's a bit tough, I can cling on to God has done this thing. Whether it be in your life and someone in your church's life or something you're seeing in AOG, what are those stories you're currently enjoying telling people and sharing about what God's
doing? I'll give you three, okay? First one, in our local church, you know, one of our principal worship leaders in our church, she's an amazing young lady, came into church many years ago, maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago, with scars all over her body. She was a cutter. She used to cut herself because of the hurt and the pain that she had in her heart. She saw people in audacious worshiping. The worship leader said, come on, everybody, lift your hands to heaven as we worship Jesus. She looked around, saw everybody else doing it. She lifted her hands and worshipped. Afterwards, in the bathroom, she screamed at the top of her voice, and people said, are you okay? What's up? And she said, look at my scars. They've gone. So all of her physical scars were taken off her body. Now, if you met her, you would not know that she'd had that pain from childhood because the transformation was so great in her heart and life. That's amazing to me, you know, that God is still doing that. We've actually seen that miracle happen twice in our church. That's a real demonstrative miracle. And we're seeing other miracles as well. Listen, let me give you another miracle. Sadly, just 4 days ago, a lady in our church died of cancer. That's really sad. But to see her small group, their small group, the husband, the widower's small group, get around them the night before she died, the night after she died, the day that she died, just to see that it's not been programmed, it's not been engineered by anybody, it's just people loving the hurting. And I just think that's a beautiful picture of the church. I find that so encouraging. When I think about Assemblies of God, since May 2022, and here we are recording this in October 2024, we've planted 89 new churches in that time frame. That's really exciting. We're ahead of our target. In 2022, we launched a 6-year church planting program to launch 400 new churches in that time. And so we're ahead of target on that. I think that's fantastic. And then when I look globally in the Assemblies of God group of churches that we're a part of, there are 10 times more Assemblies of God churches globally than McDonald's restaurants. An Assemblies of God church is being planted every 2 minutes and 58 seconds. And the trajectory we're on means that we believe that we're going to be a movement of churches, that right now we're 420,000, that by Pentecost 2033, we're believing to be a million strong. Now listen, even if we get halfway there, that's a good attempt. So I think, you know, everywhere we look, I think we get what we're looking for as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about the hummingbird and the vulture. They both fly over the same desert. The vulture lives off the carcass of dead animals. The hummingbird lives off the pollen from little fruit. They both get what they're looking for. And I actually think that when it comes to the realm of faith, faith is not being oblivious to the problems, but it's not putting a head in the sand and ignoring them, but it's about actually declaring, God, you're here, God, you're on the move, and we're here to be used by you if you want to use us.
Yeah, that's really encouraging. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about the global picture, because I know you travel a lot. And you know, where in the world should demoralized church leaders in the UK be looking for encouragement? You know, I think so much of what we do as a magazine, there's a lot of well-known, particularly American pastors who get a lot of airtime, write a lot of books, do a lot of conferences, and I'm not criticising that, but you sort of look east to the underground church and somewhere like Iran or China, and you hear those stories and you think, do we in the West need to be looking east a bit more than we've been looking west? I don't know what your view is on that, but just generally, what are you seeing internationally? I'd be fascinated to hear if there are those kind of underreported stories of God's doing stuff in some faraway places and the news is sort of trickling back here. You strike me as the sort of person who might have heard those stories as you've travelled around.
Well, some of them we can talk about and some we can't at this moment, as you know. But I think that one of the things that we've got to stop just celebrating is size. You know, I go to conferences where the person is speaking because their church is X amount in size. I think actually we've got to redefine success today. Success is not numeric size. Success is fulfilling the call and the plans of God for our life. And so for me, I'm looking for the authenticity of the leader fulfilling the call of God upon their lives. And definitely, there's some wonderful stories that are coming out. You know, you talk about Iran, you talk about Iraq, talk about Afghanistan. What God is doing in those countries is quite remarkable, actually. You know, when the recent withdrawal took place of the Allied troops from Afghanistan, just within months after that, I had the honour of speaking to a whole heap of pastors who were coming in from caves and forests and different things like that. They were being pursued for their life. And they were asking me to share on, how do you stay strong in your faith when you're being persecuted for it? And I was like, what do I know?
You want to sort of reverse that one and say, can you teach me a thing or two? I'm sure you've got your challenges here in Manchester, Glyn, but I think
nothing like that.
Coming after you with guns is probably not one of them.
Well, no, and I said to the person who asked me to speak, I said, listen, what do I know? I've got an eye that's not working very well, but that's got nothing to do with that. And I've got my haters on social media, but then you hear their stories about what they're doing, about how they're standing in the face of just the most horrific persecution. And that makes me think, my problems are first world problems that may seem big to me, but when I compare and contrast that with some of these stories, it's a humbling thing.
I know you've got a real interest in church history, and one of the things that maybe I'm not supposed to understand it, but it always blows my mind, is wherever the church is most persecuted, it most grows.
Yeah, I think it was Tertullian in the second century. He said that the blood of the martyr is the seed of the church. And he was picking up on that 200 years after Christ. So here we are 2,000 years after Christ. And has ever a more true statement been said than that? You'd think the devil would understand this, that the more he goes after the church, the more the church grows. And I wonder, maybe in Britain, where we're seeing a reaction to the church at large, our conservative values, our conservative, what I would say, biblical views on certain subjects, the backlash. I wonder if maybe that is preparing us for a season, maybe of national challenge for the church. But I think our history says that that's okay, because what the enemy means for bad, God can turn around for his glory, So when we look at great stories, sub-Saharan Africa, there's no bureaucracy there. A man or a woman of God goes to a tree or a building, we're going to do church, and it's amazing what happens. In Brazil right now, the amount of Assemblies of God churches being started, it's happening so quick that we actually don't have real-time statistics, because the overseers in those countries do not even know themselves how many churches there are, because it's just happening. These stories are amazing.
I love the quote about revival, that revival is coming because all your systems break.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that. Where we can't even keep up with the number of churches being planted, that's kind of a...
Yeah.
I'm sure those with the gift of administration, aren't happy.
Yeah.
Want it done properly. But there's something beautiful about when God comes, sometimes the systems... Yep. I mean, that's what you're praying for. That's what you're longing for.
Right? Yeah. Bureaucracy, I think, holds back a move of God. But maybe if we can just sort of lay down some of the systems and go, actually, when God does what God wants to do, it's not going to look like we thought it might look like, but that's okay because God's God. Can we just take our hands off the steering wheel enough to let him drive this thing? I think that's the big question.
How confident are you you're going to see revival in the UK in your lifetime?
Well, I think it depends how we define revival, doesn't it?
It does. How do you define it?
Well, it's a good question. That I think true revival transforms cultural thinking in such a way that it becomes part of thinking in maybe the seven mountains or the seven areas of society. I think that's true revival. I think sometimes we call things revival when maybe they're not quite, but they're close. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's levels of revival. Maybe I'm defining a revival like a reformation. Maybe at that level. But definitely I think revival is something that is so sweet that it causes people to change their mind on living for themselves and begin to live for others, and ultimately lives that elevate Jesus.
We mentioned that you were given that, that vision or that prophecy from God, those three things, and the third one was that you would lead AOG.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, how old were you?
No, at the time I was 21. And at the time, I wasn't even moving to England. I was going to stay in Australia. I mean, Australia is an amazing place, Sam. It's got something called the sun. And I love the sun, And so it was that night God said, go to England. And I said, what? No, I'm happy living in Australia. You'll plant a church. And I thought, only mad people plant churches. I'm not going to plant a church. Because back in those days, planting a church meant that you were a pastor who learned how to play guitar, You had to lead the worship. You had to take the offering. You also had to run the overhead projector. Remember those things? Overhead projector,
the acetates. Yeah.
And I was and in a horrible school hall that smelt of mothballs. And it was like, I'm just not doing that. And then the idea of leading Assemblies of God just seemed so conceited or vain. I told my prayer partner, and he looked at me, and this was his response. He said, "You? God's going to use you?" So, I mean, the only person I told, and he didn't believe it either.
I mean, it is exactly the sort of thing that, you know, forgive me, but people would be forgiven at the time saying, "Glenn, look, bit of youthful arrogance here." You know, it's that sort of a story. But it was
clearly... No, it really is. And when I became the national leader of Assemblies of God here in 2019, Premier actually ran an article on it, and I did get quite a lot of social media traffic from people saying that very thing. "Glenn, how arrogant of you." Now, there were some nice comments as well, don't get me wrong. But there were people who picked up on that. But it was genuinely...
But if it was genuine...
No, it was.
You, then the prophecy is...
And I've got my prayer journal. I've got it from April 1994. I wrote it down and I said to my friend, "I think this is what God's saying."
Yeah. So I guess at the time, one of those kind of pinch yourself moments, or how could that be moments. I wonder if on the other end of it happened as well, because I'm aware that since you became leader, you've quite literally... rubbed shoulders with royalty. You know, was it the king's coronation you would have attended? Was that equally kind of wow, you know, pinch yourself, how am I here kind of moment?
Yeah, that was surreal. You know, my wife and I had been on a long service leave 3 months. We were coming to the end of our long service leave, and I hadn't really prayed about the next season, I'll be honest, Sam. I'd spent a lot of time reading a lot of novels, just relaxing, swimming, having my quiet times, but not focusing on the next season. And I said to the Lord, "Lord, I need a word for the next season." And I just felt God impress on my heart two words: expect surprises. 2 days later, our queen passed away, and I was watching the news while on long service leave in Spain. And then a day later, I flew home. And that night, I jumped in bed and my emails went on my phone, and I don't really read my emails in bed, but I opened it up and there were some invites to go to Buckingham Palace to have an audience with the king before the funeral, then to be a part of the clergy procession in the funeral, and then later to be a part of the coronation. And I said to my wife, I woke her up, I said, "Do you reckon this is a joke?" I actually thought somebody was playing a practical joke, you know. Anyway, we made some calls, turned out to be the real thing. A day later, I'm actually in Buckingham Palace and I have this honour to meet the king. And I remember walking around the palace thinking, "Wow, this is amazing. This God, I don't know how this has happened." And God reminded me of the first verse that he'd given me at the start of my long service leave from Proverbs chapter 30, I think it is. It says, "Do you see the lizard? Though it is small and can be caught in the hand, it's also found in king's palaces." And I felt God speak to me in the palace, in Buckingham Palace, saying, "You think this is amazing? I can even get lizards in a palace." Now, I wasn't too sure if he was calling me a lizard or not, but the point wasn't missed, you know, on me that God can do everything. And definitely there's been, that they were surreal moments, and there have been surreal moments since. But I think as long as I can see the hand of God in it, and then that's the most important thing.
Yeah. On the Assemblies of God website, it says that you as a movement are in, quote, "process of denominational transformation," and that this will, quote, "require the leadership to bite the bullet on a number of important challenges facing the church today."
Yeah.
What are those challenges?
Well, listen, I think they're the well-published ones that, you know, in many senses become the elephant in the room in lots of conversations. You know, there's lots of fear that you talk about some things and they'll be cancelled or there'll be negative backlash. But I think it's about having a biblical orthodoxy that actually finds its basis in the timeless truths of Scripture that actually navigate and guide our lives. I think the moment that we remove Scripture or we change our hermeneutical application to suit the cultural context of the day, I think we're in danger. The most important question...
Can, on that, can I just put it to you, though? Some would say the problem here is church leaders have just backed off. They've just backed off the issue, Because as you say, fear of being cancelled, I don't want to tweet about sexuality, yep. don't want to tweet about biblical views, how yep. I read the Bible on homosexuality or transgender or whatever it is. They would put it to you, the problem's a lack of bravery. Mm. If every church leader in this country who really believed this stuff just owned it a bit more on social media, we wouldn't have the problem.
And that's a good point, actually. The question is, how do we own it and why would we own it on social media? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I really sense is, you know, Jesus actually talks about the sheep and the goats. So who are we called and by God to lead and to equip for works of service? So if the role of the pastor, prophet, pastor, you know, evangelist, etc., if it, to equip people for works of service, then why would we be speaking to the world in a way that they're not equipped for? There's no grace actually to either lead them, influence them, and they're not actually put in the domain of pastors for pastors to have pastoral care and responsibility over. So, you know, for me with social media, you know, I'm pretty big on social media in the sense of going, you know what, social media, if you want to follow me, you're not following me for a social commentary on what I think about the Prime Minister or this or that over there. If you want to know what you think about things, then come and get in our world, come and get in our church, come and be in my small group, come and be in this world, come and be a sheep and let me be a pastor to you. And in the sense of you are sheep within the flock, but in the sense of the world. But there are other ways I think that the church needs to be brave. And there are groups and ministries, there are gatherings of people that are very, very interesting right now, that I think are working a way to actually have a voice in a way that's actually listened to. I'm not too sure how much a pastor talking about certain biblical conservative views on social media is actually going to help or hinder things.
Yeah, you're not convinced that's the best.
Well, social media is the mob of
it
Rome.
Is.
And it's Acts chapter 19, you know, where there was that riot in Ephesus. Some were shouting one thing, some were shouting another. Most of them didn't even know why they were there. If I look at a normal Sunday here, a usual Sunday here in our central service, there are so many people coming into church for the very first time. And I'm conscious that our people have invited them hundreds of times to come to church. The last thing they want on the first Sunday that their brother or their work colleague, the last thing they want is their pastor doing a 3-minute, in their friend's view, rant on some social media thing that they've got no context for. I think there's better ways for us to actually have forums that we can discuss these very, very important issues.
We are fast running out of time. But just quickly on social media, you mentioned you've got a lot of followers. And, you know, if all I knew of you, Glyn, was just social media, you could form the view of, wow, like, you're travelling, you're preaching, the videos look great, you're meeting interesting people. You know, people might even say, wow, like, you're a pastor, but this looks kind of glamorous. Is it glamorous?
There are moments that are amazing, that without a doubt. But, you know, in the New Testament, Paul talks about being shipwrecked, hungry, naked, stoned, you know, beaten, left for dead, imprisoned. And then he says this, and besides all of that, I've got the burden of the church. So it's almost like if we've got these old-fashioned weighing scales, he's putting all that hardship and he's saying, that's actually not as heavy as the burden for the church.
And that's what people don't see. They don't see the mental burden of
the spiritual, the emotional, the physical.
That's not on Instagram. There's no Instagram about.
There's nothing.
Yeah.
So, you know, people come to church, they leave church. People can be critical and flippant about a pastor's preach or a comment or whatever. But the reality is it's not 9 to 5 and it's not 5 days a week. It's 24 hours a day. 7 days a week, you are burdened for your people. And I saw an amazing Facebook post actually recently by a pastor in America, and he said this, pastoring is weird. And he has these, it's about 10 stanzas, and he talks about it. And he talks about how, you know, just the heartache of pastoring. People just leave. And you've actually loved them and prayed for them, and they haven't seen you. You've actually heard about it and you fasted for them, and then they get upset by someone and they leave and you find out about it 6 weeks later. You know, there's a burden that is so heavy and actually sometimes so painful. And I think that's why they're saying the statistics of the amount of pastors, vicars and priests who want to give up is now at an all-time high, because now with the advent of social media, it's almost like relentless. So yeah, there are some really great moments without a doubt, but with blessing comes burden.
And with that burden, you need the time to switch off and to take care of yourself. You know, you said you're working a doctorate, you're heading up AOG, Audacious is doing brand new things. Is there any time left for riding your motorbike?
Do you know what? I love my motorbike. Sadly, a few years ago, I had some eye operations. So my motorbike's sitting in the garage just waiting for me, and I'm just waiting.
What do you do to switch off? If you're not
the golf. Golf, walk my dog, have coffee and brunch with my wife. Hang out with my children and my close friends. So yeah, I mean, Monday is Monday. It's my day off. I do some doctoral Zooms on a Monday, but apart from that, Monday's it.
Well, Glenn Barrett, thank you so much for inviting us to see a little bit of what's going on here at Audacious. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Great to meet you, Sam. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.